Hey everybody, this is Tim with TaxTime.com, and today I have a very special guest, Joel Johnson. Welcome, Joel.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks for joining me here today. How are you doing?
Great.
So, my friend Anthea Carson loaned me a copy of your book, Formation Attacks, and I was really impressed with it. It's kind of famous here in Colorado because you have a chapter on the fishing pole, which is, a really popular opening here, and everybody thought that was really cool. And my really good friend Francisco Baltier, you have one of his games in there as well when he beat Walter Brown in a simul. So I thought that was really cool as well. So I was really excited to see your book, and then you sent me an email the other day. You'd sent me some games, and so this worked out great. I'm really excited to have you here.
Well, there were a few fishing pole games in the first book. That Francisco Baltier game is a very good game. Anytime you can beat Walter Brown, I mean, come on, that's a great game. Anyways, but Walter Brown's quite a competitor.
So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your book? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to mention that I'm already 10 chapters into my next book.
Oh, wow.
And I do actually have a whole chapter on the fishing pole.
Oh, wow.
And Brian's already read it, and he said it brings him to tears.
Wow.
He's so excited. He can't wait till the book comes out.
Wow.
So that ought to tell you.
Wow, that's super. What's the name of your new book? Do you have a name yet? Or
yes, Formation Attack Strategies.
Oh, super.
So basically, like, the first book was kind of revolutionary because nobody really created an attack book where they used the pawn formations as the method of, separating the games out.
Right.
And actually talking about each weakness and how to actually go about all the different ways of smashing up pawn structure positions, and what all the weaknesses were. And if you look at like the other book, the other primary book, the competition basically is The Art of Attack. And they go about it differently. They go out at it about like attack motifs, basically, bishop takes h7 check and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the new book is basically, it's The Art of Attack done in the formation attack style. So it's by attack motif. So there is a chapter on the fishing pole, which has, it's like 34 pages long and has some incredible games a lot of games that even Brian had not ever seen before. I have been collecting my own games for quite a while now too. In addition to all of Brian's games, I have, hundreds of other games that I've seen.
Wow, that's great. I was going to ask you about how you divided up by pawn structure, because I thought that was really cool. And just to give the listener an idea of some of the topics, you have like a...
Well, the idea behind that book is, so you would look up a formation that you have, and you would see all the different ways of smashing it. And so then you would relate that to your game and say, okay, I had this position, it was really dominant, it looked like it, but I somehow messed it up, and I don't know really what I could have done. And this is a way to actually see, well, maybe if I had the pieces on the right squares, I could have done this or I could have done that. And so it allows you to go through a whole slew of games with those formations and see how good players just crush through these positions. They just sort of seem to, it sort of happens like through osmosis, but in reality the players know where to put the pieces to make them actually work so that they'll actually be able to finish the guy off. And so I actually go into each of these with one example game after another, showing you how to smash all the different responses that the person might have in a particular scenario.
So it's almost kind of like a reference book where you could go and you could see, okay, my opponent had a open F file, so you could look at
that chapter. Yeah, it's definitely a reference book. It's a lot of different things. I mean, some people actually read it because they love all the games, the great games in it. I use a lot of classic games and a lot of my games in the first book. the second book is actually, in some ways, I think it's going to be a lot better, because what I've done is I've gone through like thousands and thousands of games, and I've actually, my goal in the second book is to actually, I'm still going to use a bunch of my games, but not as many as I did the first book. But I'm also going to, the first book I felt kind of tied down because I like wanted to use a lot of the famous attacking games, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to get away from that. But the second book, I've found loads of unknown games from players that even I haven't heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done so much research. I've spent a whole year researching, looking for games. I'm still looking for more games, always doing that. But then, so I've got games that people have never seen before. So this is going to be exceptional. The games that are in the book, very few people are going to know about these games, which is kind of interesting.
Well, that's great. That's very cool. How would you suggest a student study your book? Like, I guess you said they could use it as a reference or just kind of go through it.
Well, I think you read the book first and then you, so you get the idea of how it's laid out and everything and play through the games and try to grasp as many ideas as you can. But then after that, you have the book, you say, okay, I just played a game. You know, what is it that I could have done better about this? You know, how could I have gone about it? Did I have something similar to the games that are in the each chapter, you see? And how should I have gone about attacking this guy, you know?
Right. Because
attacks can vary just by, you know, one piece, like a knight on f6 and as opposed to a knight on, a defensive knight on f6 or e7 makes a huge difference in the position.
Right.
You know, something as simple as that. Well, in addition, the pawns, like having a pawn on h6 or having it on h7, that also changes the position dramatically. So the weaknesses that are associated with the position based on pawn structure are really important. So that's one of the reasons why the first book was written the way it was, is because the pawn structure really dictates a lot of the piece placement, and you want to put your pieces on the right squares. If you don't put your pieces on the right squares, you find out at the end, oh, it doesn't work. If I just put my knight here instead of over there, I could have made this work.
Right, and yeah, and it seems like it doesn't. It's not just about calculation. It's kind of knowing the patterns and understanding the underlying
weaknesses.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So.
That's actually a part of the game that weaker players have a hard time dealing with. They don't really understand, how do I focus in on weaknesses? What are the weaknesses in this pawn structure? How should I be going about attacking this?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of my book, the first book, is about.
One of the things I liked about your book is you have a lot of terms that, I don't know if you made them up, but I had never heard of them before. Like,
yes, I'm a chess coach, you see, so
right.
I try to make things easier to understand. For example, I could never understand why there's a term called Zwickensuch, and what the hell does that actually mean, you see? And it's like, you know, that means nothing to me, right? And then there are some things that don't have terms.
Right.
So what I do is I try to create terms that make sense. That, you know, I teach a lot of kids, and kids don't really, you know, if you say Zwickensuch, they go Gesundheit, you know, did you just sneeze or something? What's wrong with you?
Right.
And so I give them other terms, you know, things that they'll remember, you know. So like when I say invisible defender,
right,
they get that piece that I should be able to take it, but there's a reason I can't take it. But it's not because it's defended indirectly, not directly by some other piece. And they get that. That's really easy to understand.
Yeah.
The replacement attacker is another one.
Right.
You sacrifice a piece and you replace it, like this usually happens with rooks. You go rook takes pawn check, and the guy takes it back, and then you put another rook in that same spot. But now that second rook is more powerful than the first one, because whatever you took is not in the way anymore.
Right.
You see? And so that's what I call a replacement attacker. That's really easy to understand, you know? Oh, yeah, I'm going to just replace the guy that I had there with another attacker.
Right.
Same type. So
I liked your term threat pinned as well. That was another one that I thought was, I'd never heard anything like that, but it's a very useful term.
Well, that's actually, people don't really understand the types of pins. And that's a really important pin concept that you really need to understand. You know, the fact that things are pinned not necessarily because there's a king or a queen behind them, but because there's a real threat behind there.
Right.
Whether it be a checkmate or some other thing you can, you know, combination that you can do or something like that. It's usually more sophisticated, but those are the ones that people have a hard time seeing, those moves that seem to be like magic. You know, you watch your master play and you go, I don't understand how I could even see that move.
Right.
You know, but it's because we don't think about chess the way lower rated players do. And that's actually a big topic in my next book.
Hmm.
I'm going to talk a lot about the views of the board. Like, for example, I ask a student, what's the plan in this position? And immediately, 9 out of 10 students will go, bishop takes knight, queen takes pawn, blah, blah, blah. Start analyzing. I said, I asked you what the plan was. I didn't ask you to analyze.
Right.
And they don't have any clue what that means. What does that mean? And see, and this is what I'm going to talk about, a lot of this kind of stuff. Another thing I'm going to talk about a lot is about how we view the board differently.
Mm-hmm.
We actually look at the board different than low-rated players. When we analyze, for example, here's a simple example, and I'm actually going to bring this up in the book, the next book. Most players go, how can you play a 3-minute game like this?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at my last book, you'll see I have some incredible 3-minute games.
Right.
You're like sitting there going, I would probably, there's no way I could have even calculated that much in 3 minutes.
Right.
It'd be impossible. Right? But the reality of it is you know, and even if you look at like Nakamura's Blitz games, 3-minute games, they're just off the chart. And you'd say, if I showed you that game, you would, and didn't tell you who played the game or what the time control was, you'd be saying, oh yeah, that was a 40-2 played by like a, you know, a 2500 player.
Right.
You'll go, oh no, that was Nakamura playing bullet chess.
Right.
You know, it's like ridiculous. They, you know, how can they make move after move, best move in position with no time on their clock?
Right.
How can they do that? Well, it's, the primary reason is because we don't, low-rated players overanalyze.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to try to analyze every friggin' move, everything. Now, I could tell you the right move without actually analyzing almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I can see what the right move is. It's because we look at the position and we don't really analyze most positions. Most positions we look at, okay, there's whatever little stuff there may be to analyze, wherever there's like a conflict where you might like where you could trade some pawns or maybe do some trading, right? Those are things we look at and we say, okay, we might have to analyze those.
Mm-hmm.
But if we realize that there's nothing there, we don't have to analyze that really. Most of the other thing is we're looking for good places to put our pieces, a hole for a knight, a nice diagonal for a bishop. Oh yeah, get my rooks over there. And then at the end of the game, when we're trying to finish them off, yeah, we'll analyze for that combination to put them away. But for the most part, the middle part of the game, the opening part of the game, we know our opening's cold.
Right.
So we're playing moves like boom, 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 right? Then we get to a middle game. And now all of a sudden we go into this mode where, okay, we're trying to improve our pieces. We're trying to keep his pieces away. You can see that at a glance. You don't need to analyze. It takes no time at all.
Right.
Matter of fact, your brain moves much faster than your hand can move a piece. While we're actually thinking, while we're actually moving the mouse to put the piece on the square, we're actually still analyzing.
Right.
You know, we're all ready for the next move. So it's like your brain can actually go warp speed. Another example I use related to this is if you've ever played baseball and you go to a batting cage.
Yeah.
Now, if you step in the very, very fast one where it says like 95 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you go to hit the thing, it's like your brain and your mind and everything is like going in slow motion.
Right.
And it seems like the ball is like 10 feet behind you before you even started to swing. But if you actually go from the, you know, you move your way up, you start with the medium, and then you go a little bit faster and a little bit faster, and then you work your way up to the very fast, right off the bat, you can actually foul the ball off.
Right.
Now, why did that happen? It was because your brain and your mind and your body is capable of operating at warp speed, but the problem is you're accustomed to moving slow.
Mm-hmm.
So most players say, I can't move that fast. So the two issues are, one, I'm not accustomed to moving that fast. I don't feel comfortable doing it. And when you immediately drop me into the lake and say, I need to move real fast, I'm not very successful. I get wiped out. And then I say, I can't do this. This is no way I can do this. Well, I think everybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anybody who can't do it. And it becomes, then the issue becomes will or won't, not could or can.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah, I know in one part of your book you talk about how some of your students, they're afraid to make mistakes, and, you know, it kind of hinders their learning.
Yes.
You mentioned that.
They get hooked up on the rating system. You know, right. I have a lot of top 100 students, mm-hmm, in the U.S.
Right.
I've taught at least 12 kids in the top 100. I have two twins that are on the list right now who just started in January. Their first ratings were 667.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has just broken 1900. We're talking like 9 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And one of them's broken 1900. The other one is like 1740 or something, but they're both easily over 2000 strength. The one kid actually had a stretch on. He beat me 3.5 out of 4.
Wow.
And my rating is like was 2332 when he did that, and he cost me a few points. So I'm like just below 2300 now.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure I'll get it back. I've already beaten him a couple times since, but it's like brutal. I now realize I have to prepare for him.
Oh, wow.
Where I was just taking it for granted that I could just beat him, just show up and beat him.
Wow.
It's gotten to that point. Created a monster. Even like Brian, you know, Brian with Tyler Hughes. You know, there reaches a day when you realize, oh, crap. This isn't going to work out so well.
Right.
You have different hats. You have the coach hat.
Right.
And then you have the player hat. The player hat doesn't want to lose any games.
Yeah.
When you got that hat on. And then the coach hat wants to say, yeah, great job, but why'd you have to beat me? Go beat somebody else up.
Well,
that's why I'm training you.
I was looking at your rating history, and you've played an incredible amount of games. I think you're coming up on 1,000 rated events here. So I think that's great that, you know, you're not just a chess author and coach, but you're also out there, you know, playing and putting your rating on the line. And, you know, I think that's great.
You know, that the sad part of that is?
What's that?
They're missing 30 years of my playing.
well, right, yeah, it only goes back.
That's only 1990, right? My best years were in the early 80s.
Right.
I was ranked fourth in Massachusetts in the early 80s.
Oh, okay.
So it's like kind of funny that, you know, the people say, "Oh, wow, you played a lot of games." I say, "Like, they've wiped out over half of my games."
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about how you got into chess and kind of your chess background and?
I was born in Brockton, Massachusetts, and it's a kind of a middle class town, a tough town. Obviously, there's been a couple of world champion boxers from Brockton, Massachusetts. Marvelous Marvin Hagler and Rocky Marciano were both from Brockton, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived there till I was 9. My mom used to drop us off. She was a single, well, sort of single. My dad got in a car accident when I was really young and had permanent brain damage.
Oh, wow. Sorry to hear that.
And so what happened is she used to drop us off at the Y a lot. And there were two older guys that used to play chess there all the time. I never played chess with them, but I used to sit and watch because I was really fascinated by the game. And I actually learned how the pieces move and everything. And then when my mom got remarried, we moved to Lowell, Massachusetts, which is probably even more famous. It's also a tough town. there's a new movie out about one of the boxers, Dick Eklund. He's played by Mark Wahlberg in the movie.
Oh, yeah, I saw that movie, The Boxer or The Fighter or something.
Yeah, the funny part is that opening scene is very close to where I grew up.
Okay.
In Lowell. From age 10 on, I lived in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Another tough town.
Right.
So, I'm a big guy, and we were a Brady Bunch family. There was three boys and a girl, and I was like the oldest of five boys within 4 years. So I was like always having to protect my brothers and stuff from gangs and stuff.
Oh, wow.
So it was a rough growing up. But and so I was more into sports growing up. I didn't really play much chess. It seemed like every time I played somebody, like the first person I played was my older stepbrother. He's 7 years older than me. And we must have played for about 6 months. At the beginning, I couldn't beat him. And at the end, he couldn't win a game for me. So he just quit because it's like, here he's 17 years old and he's losing to his 10-year-old brother. This is not a good thing.
Right.
So then the next player that came along was a player much better. And he was, he ended up marrying my older stepsister. So he's, again, 5 or 6 years older than me. And he beat me for a few months and then I started beating him up.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he stopped playing too. And then the next person I met was this when I was originally a Protestant, and then when we moved, when we, my mom got remarried, we all switched to Greek Orthodox because my stepdad is Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is in Sunday school I met this player named Bill Menikas. I'm actually going to talk about him in the book. He was really a good player. He was roughly 1800 strength.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like 14. And he literally beat the tar out of me game after game after game. I can't even tell you how many thousands of games I lost to him.
Wow.
But it seemed like every week I did not draw one game. I didn't win one or draw one. He just kept beating me and beating me and beating me. And this happened for like 2.5 years.
Wow.
And I did not win one game or draw one game. I just couldn't believe somebody could be this good.
Wow.
And it's funny how your perspective changes as years go by.
Right.
Because we all know 1,800 players really aren't that good. But at the time, he seemed like God, a chess god.
Right.
So then what happens is I end up... So this is like I'm like 15 now, and I'm a sophomore in high school. And the next year, junior, I have a math teacher who happens to be the chess coach at the school, at Lowell High School.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees that I'm fantastic at math, so he goes, he asked me if I played chess. And I go, yeah, I play chess. And so I played a player at the club. I killed the first game, then I beat him 2 in a row. And then they pair me against the best player in the club. I lose the first game, a really long game. And then I draw with them. And they go, you're on the chess team. And I go, I am? It was kind of a shock to me. It's because I hadn't played in over a year.
Right.
So anyways, so that year I started playing a lot of speed chess. From there, that was the upcoming summer after junior was summer of 72, which was Bobby Fischer's World Championship.
Right.
And that was on PBS with Shelby Lyman, who writes the column for the New York Times.
Right.
Chess column for the New York Times. And actually, that would turn out to be important in my life, but I'll get into that later. And some of the guys he used to have on there were like Eugene Meyer, an international master, who I actually... played twice, which is funny because that's one of the games in the book is probably my most famous king hunt is my game against him in the last round of the Bermuda International. I had black and I marched his king all the way from H1 down to E7.
Oh, wow.
for mating him. It's really funny. And a bunch of sacks and everything. It's just crazy. but there wasn't much he could do about it. So it happened that that whole year I played loads of Blitz. I met all these chess players, you know, and I'm playing a lot. And during the summertime, they had the World Championship match. I'm watching that every day, studying. And then also a friend of mine had the guy that used to play most of the Blitz with. A friend of his actually got out of the Army, and he used to play chess at the Army. And his rating was around 1600 or so.
Uh-huh.
At the beginning of the summer, I was like about even with him, and the other guy I used to beat all the time. And then by the end of the summer, I could beat both of them like game after game after game. So what happens is now it's time I find out about USCF rated chess. I had no clue there was even such a thing.
Oh, wow.
And then as a senior, somehow a flyer got put in my possession. I don't remember how. And about a chess tournament. So I go to the chess tournaments at the Prudential in Boston, which is a huge building, one of the tallest buildings in the, you know, in Boston, right?
Right.
So I go there, and they have it at the cafeteria, and because it's the Fisher effect, everybody's playing chess now. All of a sudden, it's like the thing to do,
right?
You know, and it's like the place is mobbed. This place is huge. The cafeteria holds like, I don't know, 500 people, and it's overflowing. There's so many people.
Oh, wow.
And so anyways, it's my first tournament. I had no coach to tell me about, you know, how to keep score, what a chess clock was, you know, all of these things. So I was very green, even though I was actually a pretty good player even already.
Right.
I had learned, I understood a lot about chess, but I didn't really understand about tournament chess. You know, it's a big difference, really.
Right.
So anyways, what happens is I go 2-2 against like 4 1100 players. So the next tournament, so I'm feeling much better about the next tournament. So now that I immediately get a clock, I start learning how to keep score. So 2 weeks later, I play in another tournament. This time I play, it's a much tougher tournament. And I beat like the 1200, I beat a 1400. And then in the third round, I get paired with a 1650 and I drew. And in the last round, I'm playing like the second best high school player in the state, and his rating is like 19 something.
Uh-huh.
And I have him totally busted, and I blew the game. I blew not only the win, I blew the draw. It's like a 90 move game. I'm totally exhausted. It's the last round. I've never played a tournament like this or played like games like this, so I ended up choking the game. So I get 2.5, 1.5, though. That's pretty respectable.
Right.
Considering the players I played, much better than the first tournament. So the third tournament happens to be the high school championship from my area. So I show up. It's the Merrimack Valley High School Championship. And I get there. I walk in the place. There's loads of players. I'm actually going to talk about this story in the next book.
Okay.
So anyways, what happened is I show up there. I look around. Guess who's there? That Greek kid that used to beat me.
Oh, wow.
Like, no tomorrow. What I find out, he's the defending champion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so he's ranked actually number 2 in the tournament. There's a player slightly higher than him. So they're, like, both 1800s, right? Anyways, so what happens is this is the first round I win, second round, and I'm ranked, like, I'm still unrated because in the old days the ratings took a long time to come out. So, the second round, I'm on board 1, playing the best player in the tournament with black, and he's sitting right next to me, my Greek friend.
Right.
And so I clobber the best guy in 20 moves. I absolutely paced him. His jaw just drops. He's like, he can't believe this, right?
Oh, wow.
So the third round, I win that too. So this in the last round, there's 4 of us with 3 points. I ended up getting paired against the other guy from his high school, and he got paired with a third-ranked guy. And I won my game, and he drew, and I took his title away.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. So, and my whole thing is that I tell this story to my students because you should never give up.
Right.
Chess is kind of personal, and it's easy to take it as a loss as kind of personal, like I'm no good, I stink, I can't do this. But the problem is chess, there aren't enough really bad players. So what happens is you have to really, like, it's like you have to try to make the, like, minor leagues from Little League. It's like the leap is so great.
Right.
For a start, because you have to think about all the knowledge you need to be like a competitive, like even 1300 player.
Right.
You might think that, oh, well, you know, 1300 is not that good. But the problem is from a beginner standpoint, it's a huge leap to make it all the way up to there, because there just aren't that many players who are lower. Because a lot of them quit because they just figure they can't do this. I just can't do this. You know, some people just can't accept losing. They can't see the long-term goals and that all the great things that chess provides you, you know. Well, there's a lot of great things about chess, and it's worth it to stick it out, because then you get to reap the benefits eventually when you do get better.
Right. Well, that's a great story, Joel, and that's a great point, too, because, yeah, even the 1,300 can beat, you know, 99% of the U.S. population at chess, so...
Exactly, and usually you need to get to that strength in order to be able to compete at least on a minimal basis.
Right.
If you go to a tournament and you're lower than that, you're going to get swamped.
Right. So, well, thank you so much, Joel, for your time today. I really enjoyed chatting with you, and I wish you a lot of good luck with your next book. It sounds wonderful, and I'd encourage everyone to check out your current book, Formation Attacks. If someone wanted to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
My email is bigbear12@hotmail.com.
Okay, great. Anything else you'd like to add before we go here?
That sounds pretty good. Maybe we could talk some more other times. There's a lot more things I can talk about.
Okay.
If you get me started, you see what happened. I start going like crazy.
Okay, yeah, I'd love to do that, because, my site's focused on, you know, tactics, and, you know, you're like a tactical genius looking at your games and your book and your writing, and, you know, I'd love to talk again. That'd be great.
Good. Maybe we can make this the first part of two, and we can get together another time in a couple of weeks or something.
Okay, well, thanks, Joel. Appreciate it.
Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good one.
Okay, bye-bye. You too. Bye.